Let's get into the Word. We're in Genesis chapter 9. Genesis 9. You know, I don't know about you, but I'm amazed that God keeps hanging in there with us. You know, long after we would give up on people, and actually after we do give up on people, sometimes I think to myself that it isn't until after I've given up that God actually goes to work on somebody. It's like, okay, knock yourself out, boya. And then when I'm done, I just go, Lord, I'm giving up. That one's not going to ever come to you. And you know, then like a year later, I find out the Lord did this marvelous thing in their life. I'm shocked. I want to just turn in my minister badge. You know, it's like, man, Lord, I thought you were supposed to tell me everything you were doing, and then I could be like your agent here, you know, and then I'd always know what's going on. It's not that way. He is at work at times when we would have given up, and sometimes his design, as strange as it may seem, I am convinced, there are times when his design is that we actually do give up. You know, he never says that the salvation of humanity is up to humanity. He never says that. In fact, it says salvation is of the Lord. Humans actually have a role to play in their own personal salvation. But you know, the Lord never gave up his sovereignty to humans. He always has been at work, and he will always be at work. And that to me is actually, after I get over the ego bruise, it's really a source of great comfort to just humble out and realize the Lord is not giving up. You may need to give up on some things, but he is not giving up on humanity. He's not giving up on people that you would give up on. He didn't give up on you when you gave up on yourself, if you remember. It is amazing the way the Lord works. And even in the midst of judgment, even in the midst of the very worst judgment, which we've been reading about here in Genesis, the flood, the worst judgment on the earth to date was actually the flood. It was the most catastrophic occurrence on the earth to date. And even in that, the Lord was at work. It is an amazing thing. He looked at the earth and there was only one guy who would walk with him. And he said, I'll take that guy and we'll start over with him. Instead of saying, let me just take that guy to heaven, we'll scratch the whole project and I'll do something else with eternity, you know? Instead of that, he said, I'll take this man and I will judge the evil of the earth, and then I'll put him back on the earth and we will start again. We're gonna keep doing it till we get it right, Noah. I'm amazed at that. And it is a tribute to God's providence. It is a tribute to his wisdom. It is a tribute to his mercy and his grace that he takes humanity and keeps working with them. And it's why, really, he tells us not to lose heart. No matter how bad things get, he tells us not to lose heart. No matter how many failures we see and how many difficulties we see, he tells us not to lose heart because he's always doing something. He's always doing something behind the scenes. We finished last time the flood narrative itself, and we ended in the end of chapter 8 with Noah getting out of the ark and offering sacrifice to the Lord. And what we're going to do this evening is we're going to pick up there, and then we're going to go through chapter 9. We won't get beyond chapter 9 this evening because there's some important things to look at. We want to take some time with them. But let me remind us that what he's doing the end of chapter 8 and through chapter 9 is he's restarting everything. I want you to compare this with Genesis chapters 1 and 2, okay? Because it's very similar. He remember in the creation account, it said that the Spirit was brooding over the deep, and out of that he created, and then he put Adam and Eve there, and then he developed the creation. Well, now what's happened is the creation, because of human sin, got so bad that the Lord said, I'm going to judge it and we're going to start again. And there's a very real parallel in Genesis 9 with Genesis 1 and 2. He doesn't recreate the earth, but in a sense, there's so many differences when you look at the Noahic covenant, which we're going to look closely at in chapter 9. You see that there's some real strong parallels, and he really is starting over. He's starting over. And in the original language, there's even more parallels that we're not going to look at. But it's obvious that the author, Moses, intended us to see that God starts over and that what he's doing with Noah is basically sort of like a second Adam. I need to be careful with that because that's actually the name, that the title for Jesus in the New Testament. One of the titles for Jesus is the second Adam. But in a limited sense, I want to use the term, sort of the second Adam is what happens here with Noah. He actually begins a brand new work. He takes one man who worships him, and he says, I'm going to start with you, and we'll rebuild the entire human race. You are all descendants of Noah. We all are. And we'll see a little more about that next week in the dispersal of the sons and their families and roughly kind of where they went. And so he's restarting. And I want to point out, in chapter 8, beginning in verse 20, Noah built an altar to the Lord and took of every clean animal and of every clean bird and offered burnt offerings on the altar. And the Lord smelled the soothing aroma. And the Lord said to himself, and note it's to himself, not to Noah, said to himself, I will never again curse the ground on account of man, even though the intent, and that's really how that should be translated probably, even though the intent of mankind's heart is evil from his youth. And I will never again destroy every living thing as I have done. While the earth remains, underline that line in verse 22, while the earth remains, seed time and harvest and cold and heat and summer and winter and day and night shall not cease. In other words, what he's saying is I'm not going to undo this. Now we'll look at this more carefully in a moment. But I want to simply point out here, he's restarting, and what he's doing is he's restarting with worship. He's restarting worship. I want you to see the earth as, in essence, dead, and the Lord restarting life on it. Like, you know, in the hospital where they take those paddles and kaboom, you know, clear, boom, you know, and just start. Okay, now first thing he does is he starts worship. Do you ever realize that when that happens in your soul, it's almost like God reached down and said, clear, boom. And something starts inside of you. You say, I want to worship God. I want to be a worshiper of God. And that's a new life for you when that happens. He says, I'm starting over with humanity. And the very first thing that's going to happen after this incredibly horrible judgment in which everything is killed, the very first thing that's going to happen when he steps out of that ark is he's going to start by worshiping me. There's the beginning, restarting worship. Then you'll notice in chapter 9, he restarts the covenant. The covenant that he had with Adam, he restarts with some special stipulations in chapter 9. He restarts the covenant. Now, this has to happen because humanity does not function. I repeat, humanity does not function without a covenant with God. You've got to be connected with God if you're going to function, and humanity has to have a covenant with him. There's no such thing as human life without God overseeing it in some way. And so he starts again. He says, we're going to start with a new covenant. I'm going to have an agreement with you. You're going to have an agreement with me. And we'll see some things about that. It's very interesting. It's fascinating. But then the third thing we're going to see, and it's in the last half of chapter 9, and I don't know if you've read ahead. I won't have a show of hands for fear of embarrassment. But or lying. You see, it's a temptation to lie, you know, raise your hand. Yes, I've read ahead, Pastor, you know, and then you have to repent later and all that, and it's a bummer. So I won't even ask, but if you did read ahead, you notice in the end of chapter 9, there's an odd little story about some sin that occurs. And he's not restarting sin, but it is a reminder that even in this restarted creation, the insidious nature of sin is still there. Now, he said, I will not destroy the earth, even though the heart of humanity is evil from their youth. And what we see in this section we're going to look at tonight is a restarting of worship, a restarting of covenant, and the continuation behind the scenes of the sin of humanity. It does not go away because of the judgment. But God decides to deal with it in a rather unique way, and that's kind of the story of the rest of the Bible, is how he deals with it. So watch for those things, the restarting of worship, the restarting of covenant, and the continuation of sin subtly, quietly, behind the scenes in the human soul. And we'll see how that progresses. Now, last week I told you that I was going to begin this week by reviewing what we ended last week with, because this flood narrative reminds us of the five things that are most important, and I'm just going to briefly go through them, and then we'll look at these issues. The flood narrative and the life of Noah in general reminds us of the five things that are always true in the life, in a redeemed life. And I want you to consider them in your own life. I want you to kind of hold your life up to the light for a moment and say, are these things true of me? Number one, of course, is faith. And that's why Noah is quoted in Hebrews chapter 11, when in the faith, the great faith chapter, when it says that he trusted God, he believed what he said, and based on that, he did what was the appropriate thing to do. If he's going to trust God, he's going to build that ark, which he did do. And so the writer to the Hebrews says, this is faith, and then he draws from that. This is the only way you can ever get to know God. The only way you will ever get to know God is if you reach out and trust him. If you say, no, I'm not going to trust God. If he wants my trust, he's going to have to come here and appear to me. I've had people say stuff like that, you know. And I just say, no, he's not going to do that. Well, then he must not want me very bad. Believe whatever you want to believe. I mean, his son died for you. He created you. He gave you life. You didn't give it to yourself, pal. But hey, if you don't want to believe that God loves you, if you don't want to believe that God's there, that's your decision. Make no mistake about it. It is your decision. If you're going to stand back and fold your arms and say, I'm going to wait for God to prove himself to me, you're going to wait a long time because he's already proved himself enough. He'll stand back and fold his arms at that point. So faith is vital. And Noah is actually the expression of it. I mean, his whole life is that way. You've got to believe that God is and that he is a rewarder of people who seek him, is what it says in Hebrews. And the classic example is Noah, and that's why it's used there. Secondly, righteousness is illustrated in this. Remember what God said? He looked at Noah and he said, you alone I have found to be righteous on the earth. Therefore, I'm going to put you in the ark. The whole point of righteousness is completely lost in our world. The Hebrew term tzaddik actually means to be straight, to do what's right. And it can mean, you know, have different applications in different situations, but it means to do what is right and to live a life that is right. And it means literally straight rather than crooked, rather than off the beam or not correct or whatever the case may be. And in the New Testament, it is this righteousness that's given to us in Jesus Christ because we cannot seem to ride our bikes in a straight line. We just can't do it. We cannot function just going straight in our thinking and in our words. We deviate all the time. And so what the Lord did is he gave to us righteousness. Never underestimate the need for righteousness. Noah is the illustration of the need for righteousness. His salvation was based on the grace of God in giving to him righteousness, actually. You say, well, is righteousness important? Yeah, it's used over 300 times in the Bible. It is the absence of righteousness that makes us go to hell. It is the presence of righteousness that takes us into heaven. The only problem is we can't come up with it on our own. I'm amazed at people who, well, no, I'm not amazed really because we tend to be ignorant about these things. But the fact of the matter is the Bible teaches clearly that you have to be righteous to go to heaven. And Christians who don't understand that, who think that that's legalism, don't understand their salvation. The fact is, you're going to heaven because you're righteous. No. You're misinterpreting it, see? I didn't say because you are righteous all by yourself in your own self-righteousness. If you understand what salvation is, because Jesus gave you his righteousness, but if he didn't give it to you, you couldn't go. People don't understand that. And that's why they have a low view of sin. They don't think about it. They don't worry about it. And if you talk about it, you're quite old-fashioned. Well, the Bible's old-fashioned. Righteousness is important. And the Noah story is absolutely the illustration of it. Obedience is the third point. Every time you find people who walk with God, you find people who will say, Lord, if that's what you're telling me, then that's what I'm going to do. And in Noah's case, he didn't know what God was going to do. All he knew was what God told him to do. And that's the point I want to bring out. God doesn't tell you everything. He just says, I just want you to play your instrument. You don't have to write the music, and you don't have to write everybody else's part. You only have one instrument to play. Gail Irwin, you guys know Gail Irwin. He says, I have a guitar with one string. And he says, I just play that one, you know, everywhere. And it's absolutely true, and it's wonderful. You've got a guitar with one string, too. You may think you've got a whole orchestra there in your head, but actually you do one thing. You might do two. Maybe your guitar has two strings if you're really, really talented. All you got to do to live for God in your generation is do what he calls you to do. And that's all Noah did. But you do have to do that. You do have to say, Lord, who am I in you? How have you created my life? What is my responsibility? I will do that. And sometimes it's a lot simpler. Some people spend their lives worried they're not doing the right thing. And they're doing what is absolutely the right thing. But they're all, you know why? They read too many, this is heresy, I know. But they read too many Christian books that heap guilt upon them for not being Billy Graham. If he wanted two Billy Grahams, he'd have made two Billy Grahams. If he wanted two of anybody else, he'd have made two of them. You don't have to be exactly like everybody else. But you do have to serve the Lord where he has put you now. And to the very best of your ability, trust him and obey him. And that's all Noah did. And that's why he's the great illustration of it. He built a boat. He did not make it rain. He did not make the animals get in the boat. They came to him. He did not even close the door of the boat. He didn't create a way to close the door. It was too big. God closed the door. Noah only did his part. God did everything else. And a lot of times we just get real anxious because we think, you know, we're supposed to do more. Now, some people are on the other end of the spectrum, and they don't really think at all about serving the Lord in their life, and that's another story. But all I want to point out is wherever you find people who know God, you find that they trust him. There's faith. They really believe in him, and they will trust his revelation, what he says, and they'll live by that. And you also find that there is righteousness. It is given to them, and they live in it. They live, in essence, what you would call straight lives. They live lives that are right. And it's not that they never make mistakes and never sin, but when they do sin, they feel bad, they repent, they weep and gnash their teeth, and then they get back in line again. That's what happens over and over. So the overall average is they're living a straight life. And then you find obedience. You find them seeking to serve the Lord. And it's a relatively simple procedure. It's not super complex. Then number four, you find waiting. He had to wait for the rain. He had to wait to build the thing. 120 years it took him to build it. Raised his whole family with this project in the backyard. They never knew anything else. The kids were working on it. Oh, we got to work on the boat again today, Dad. Yeah, you got teenagers? Boat chores today. Dad, we don't even know what a boat's supposed to do. It's never rained, never seen a flood. You keep telling us it's going to happen. I tell you, you've been doing this our whole life. Yeah. But then when it rained, they were really glad. So, waiting. Then he got in there, and he was on there for over a year on the boat with the animals and the kids. On the boat for a year. But you see, here's the deal. In waiting, when you're walking with God, Noah's point was, God started this, God's going to have to finish it. You ever feel like you have to finish the things that God starts? And they're just too big a project for you? You know, my friend, what God starts, God finishes. And maybe you just need to say, all right, if I'm going to float here for a year, I'm going to float here for a year. If I'm going to float for 2 years, I'm going to float for 2 years. He started it. He's going to finish it. You know, that's why Noah had to send the birds out to go. And remember the raven and then the dove, you know? You know why he did that? Because God didn't tell him how long he was going to be in there. That's why he did that. And he was trying to find out. So he sent the birds to find out. And one of them came back with an olive branch, and he thought, oh, good, we're almost done, maybe. And then it was another 2 months after the thing hit ground. And he waited until God said, okay, that's it. Now you can get out. Waiting. And you know your Christian life, you're always waiting for something. You're waiting to get married, and then you're waiting for kids, and then you're waiting for money. It usually goes in that kind of. And then you're waiting for this, and you're waiting for the next thing, and you're waiting for the next phase, and oh, I can hardly wait. And I'm waiting and waiting. And then you're just waiting to go and be with Jesus. Because you're all of the stuff you've lived out through your whole life, and you get to the point where you just say, I'm waiting for the Lord to take me home. And honest and truly, that is true. That is true. You're always waiting for something. Which means, whether you like it or not, God's timing is the only thing that really matters. Is that not true? So you might as well relax in the ark and wait. And I tell you, it's one of the characteristics of faith. You will always have to wait for something. There's something in your life right now you're waiting for. And when that thing gets there, there'll be something else you'll be waiting for. So, welcome to the club. There's no easy answer for that. Except it helps to know that it's okay. Part of being a Christian. There's always faith, righteousness, obedience, and waiting, and finally, worship. There is worship. And that's where we get back into that little passage that we just looked at. He took those animals, verse 20 of chapter 8. He took a bunch of the animals he'd been on the ark with for so long, and these are whole burnt offerings. What they did is they would drain the blood out of them. They would slaughter them, which in that culture was, I mean, you have not had to ever slaughter anything. It's entirely possible in this culture you could live your whole life and never have to slaughter an animal. However, it was not true in that culture. Anybody over the age of understanding probably had either seen or been physically involved with a slaughter because of hunting and so on. And if not that, at least sacrifices. And before the flood, apparently the animals that they used, that they did slaughter, were for sacrifices rather than for food. We'll see that in just a minute. So it was not an uncommon practice. And then what they would do is they would burn the body of the entire animal, a reminder that there needs to be a sacrifice in order to come into God's presence. Even though they didn't understand all the theology of that like we do from the New Covenant, still the rudimentary realities were there, and that's what he does. Now, these are free will offerings. There was not a law, at least not an elaborate one, like we have in the Mosaic Law. These are free will offerings that he did because he just wanted to, whole burnt offerings, free will offerings, the most common sort of offering in the Old Testament. And one that reminded him of his dependence on God. It reminded him of his desire to worship God and to obey God. All of that was involved in these offerings. And worship is always that way. Whenever you worship in the New Covenant, what we do is we come, we sing, we give, we contribute our time, we worship the Lord in a number of different ways. We don't make blood sacrifices because that's already been done. Jesus fulfilled all of this. But we still come with the sacrifice of praise and worship. And when you come and you worship here, or anywhere you go, even if the style is not exactly your style, you be sure that you open your heart up to God. When you're in a worship service or a praise time with any group of believers, you be sure you're making a sacrifice of real praise to the Lord. Will you open your heart up to Him and you address Him and you remind Him that you love Him and you want to walk with Him and you're dependent on Him? And usually in hymns and choruses, you will find those kinds of things all expressed in the things that are being sung. So you find worship and praise, and that's what you find here among all of God's people and specifically here. Now, when he does this, something happens in heaven. I want you to note what it is. These are God's thoughts. Now, we'll start moving in and explaining. This is the restarting of humanity. And he says this thing to himself in verse 21. And one of the reasons we need to point that out is because if he said it to Noah, it would be as though Noah were sort of manipulating God with his sacrifices. You don't manipulate God with your sacrifices. You obey him with them, but you never manipulate him with them. He's not like magic, where like if you do this and you do this incantation and you do this just the right way, bingo, that happens. Which is why, I don't know if you've ever done this, but I have, especially when I was younger. I've given up now. But when I was younger, I used to think if I could get the right formula in devotions, I would get everything I wanted from God. I need to have the right formula. So I'd tweak the formula a little longer, a little more Bible reading, a little more prayer, add a fast or two. That's a really cool thing. God will look, oh, that guy's really hungry. I better do what he wants. And I thought, and then I realized there was no direct correlation between success in what I was attempting and any of my techniques. Have you noticed that? Like sometimes when you think you've been the most spiritual, stuff goes wrong. And sometimes when you forgot to be spiritual that day, you just kind of went through your day. Some really great thing happens and you think to yourself, I don't see a direct correlation between what I'm doing and what I'm getting. Man, how frustrating. It's a good thing, because if there were a direct correlation, that would not be dealing with a person called the Lord. That would be dealing with magic, where you are manipulating spiritual powers to get what you want every single time. And then who would be the Lord in a situation like that? Who would be the Lord? You would. And so the Lord says, neener, neener. I'm the Lord. I am going to do what I've called you to do, these things, to pray and to be in the Word and all these things, and even fast. But you don't manipulate me by these things. Understand that this is a personal relationship in which I am not manipulated. Now that really sets you free from a whole lot of magical thinking. And that's exactly why in these verses, it's very important that you read the English, a good English translation, which should say, God said to himself these things. Now this is the deliberation of God, which then comes out in a covenant later, as we'll see in just a moment. But notice what he says is, first, I'm not going to curse the ground, even though the intent of man's heart is always evil. And there's no intrinsic change in the human heart. Secondly, he says, I'm not going to destroy every living thing again like this. And third, he says, I'm going to have continuity in the seasons. By the way, it says in verse 22, while the earth remains. And that's very key. That's why I had you underline it. Because he doesn't say the earth is going to remain forever. But he says, while it does remain, I'm not going to have humanity being afraid of nature. And we'll see that a little bit more. I mean, we are afraid of nature in a lot of ways, but he says, I'm not going to have humanity thinking that this kind of a disaster is going to happen again. He says, I'm going to set some standard things and I'm not going to mess with them. And it's interesting, as I pointed out last week, that this continuity in the created order is exactly why some people, that's the argument some people use for the fact that God might not be doing anything or might not even be there. They use the continuity he said he was going to put in against him. They say, well, things have always been this way. It's always this way. The seasons come and go and so on. And it escapes their notice that in all of our space exploration, there's never been, at least so far, any place that even remotely resembles Earth. In fact, if you read in scientific literature, it says things like this. I'm paraphrasing, but it's really there. It's an amazing happenstance that Earth just happens to have the perfect environment to support human life. What an amazing coincidence. They write stuff like that. It's just the most amazing thing that Earth just happens to have. You know, this continuity and the seasons and the moisture and the whole thing. It's just, wow, what an amazing coincidence that just happens to happen here. The only place that they've ever found in the universe, everywhere they go. The most beautiful planet. It just happens to happen here. What a coincidence. God says, look, I made it that way. It's going to be this way to support human life. And it's going to be consistent. So you don't have to be afraid of it anymore. By the way, this is also a slam against the fertility gods. Remember, this was written by Moses at a time when fertility deities were big time. And they were going to be going into Canaan, where fertility gods and goddesses were everywhere. And in order to make the ground fertile, you can guess what people did in fertility rites that they thought had spiritual impact on the gods so that the gods would make the land fertile. That's why the fertility rites in Canaan were so debauched. They were so horrible. These fertility gods and goddesses. You see what Moses is saying here? Hey, everybody who belongs to God, let's understand that fertility rites and fertility gods and goddesses are a waste of time. God said, I'm going to send rain. God said, I'm going to send heat. God said, I'm going to do all this stuff. So part of why he's writing this is to explain to people they don't need those fertility rites. So the worship begins, and God thinks to himself, I'm making a decision. I am not going to destroy the earth in this way again. Now, he begins the covenant in chapter 9, restarts the covenant. God blessed Noah and his sons, and he said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground and all the fish of the sea. Into your hand they are given. Very interesting. Every moving thing that is alive shall be food for you. I give all to you as I gave, past tense, the green plant. Only you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is its blood. And surely I will require your life blood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man and from every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. Why? Because in the image of God, he made man. Some people wonder whether or not humans still have the image of God, even in a fallen state. Or have they lost the image of God completely and taken on the image of Satan? Well, they have taken on the image of Satan in a certain way, but they obviously have not lost the image of God completely. And the Lord says, human life was still created in my image, and Well, we'll see in a moment what he means by this. But he says, I'm taking human life seriously. Verse 7. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply, populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it. And God spoke to Noah and to his sons with him, saying, Now behold, I myself do establish my covenant. Well, we'll stop. I'm getting ahead of myself. The next thing he talks about is the promise. And we'll look at that in just a moment. Right now, I want you to notice the first two things about the Noahic covenant, okay? And then we'll look at the third one in a moment. The first two are blessing and responsibility. He blessed Noah and his sons. You have no idea how important it is for God to say that. When he says, I bless you, what he means is you are going to continue. And it has been that way. Again, if you read atheistic science about the survival of the human race, they will attribute it to an accident that humanity has not self-destructed. An accident that we're here in the first place, and an accident, really, that we haven't self-destructed up to this point. And if you don't believe in God, that is what it looks like. But that's not the reason why we're still here. The reason why we're still here is because God said to Noah, I will bless you. Humanity is going to multiply. And it's going to continue to multiply, and it's going to fill the earth. And this is a blessing. That's why humanity hasn't died out. It's not an accident. It's because God put a blessing on it. And this is why people in the Old Testament were willing, like Jacob and Esau, Jacob was willing to cheat and lie. Why? To get a blessing. When God says, I will bless something, that's a powerful statement. When he said, these kinds of people are blessed by me, that's a powerful statement. We go right past it because we use the word bless you for sneezing. We have no idea in our minds what it means for God to say, I will put a blessing on your life in this way. One blessing from God is worth dying for in this life. Believe it. So, the first thing to note is his plan to bless. And he takes Noah and his sons and he says, I am going to bless you. It doesn't mean no difficulties will ever happen. It doesn't mean there will not be any problems on the earth. He says, I'm going to bless you and humanity is going to accomplish these things. And they have. Even to this day, they've accomplished these things. They have multiplied on the earth. And they are multiplying at an amazing rate. Even we took this one really seriously. We are really multiplying. The second thing you'll notice is responsibility. And the responsibility is to honor human life. Verse 2. The fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky. There's an honoring of human life, and there is a management of the animal world that you see here. Now, it's interesting because it's possible that this fear wasn't there before. That may be a change that's going on. In fact, I think it was. In the original creation, the animals were not afraid of Adam. He's the one who named them. And perhaps during that entire time, before the flood, there was a cooperation between the animals and us. But after the flood, he says, this is changing. I'm putting the terror of the animals, he did put the terror of the animals on some people, too. They're scared to death of animals. But he says, I'm going to make the animals frightened to death of you. All of them, all the animals, no matter what they are, they're going to run away when they see a human being or when they smell one, which usually they smell us before they see us. Do you ever wonder why animals are scared of us? Why should a bear be scared of a human being? But just the smell of a human will send almost any animal, unless they've gotten too used to humans, or unless they're wounded or unless they're cornered, they'll usually run away. Almost all, even the most dangerous creature will almost always run away from a human being. Now, why do you suppose that is? We take it for granted. We just go, well, it's just kind of the way it is. It doesn't even occur to anybody. Maybe God made it that way. Maybe it's part of the creation. And isn't it a good thing? Because if they weren't scared of us, what have we got to protect ourselves? Well, now we have weaponry. But if you don't have weaponry, my friend, and you're in the woods, you better be glad they don't like your smell. We used to hike in the Canadian wilderness, and we'd carry rifles with us, of course. But it was bear country, and even with a rifle, it was a little scary. And when you'd sleep, you would wonder, you'd sleep very lightly, listening to every little creak in the woods out there. Even though you know they're out there, and you know God told them they're supposed to be scared of you, You sometimes wonder which one of you got more scared. I was really frightened of them. We came across a couple of critters one time. I do not know what they were because they were in the bushes. And they were making a racket getting away from us. You could tell they were very heavy. They were very big. And I suspect they were bear. But I'm glad they were running the other way. And I'm glad because, you know, we were about ready to, you know, run the other way. Do you ever wonder why that is? If it wasn't true, we'd be dead. God says, I'm going to put the fear, because I'm putting into life now killing. He says that in just a moment. I'm going to give the animals to you for food. Apparently there's a change after the flood in which the relationship between man and animal actually changes. And part of it is involved in fear. And then he says, I'm going to give it to you for food, verse 3, as I gave to you the green plant. So apparently animals are going to be food, not just vegetables. And apparently vegetarian, it was the standard thing just to eat veggies before the flood. I mean, that's just a deduction. It doesn't actually say it, but it seems to be that that's what he's saying, because he's making a change here. But then he says, you will not eat the flesh with its life in it. That means it's blood. You have to drain the blood out. You cannot drink the blood. And you can't eat it in any way. And the reason he says this is because all life belongs to him. And even to this day, in cultures around the world, when people come in contact with a culture that drinks blood, there is an instinctive revulsion. An instinctive revulsion. I remember a guy years ago who's famous, but I'm not going to use his name, who was famous for drinking ox blood. And he would drink it in front of other people. He was a bodybuilder. And he was well known for this. And at the time, I thought it was kind of weird. You know, I was a kid when I knew about this guy. And at the time, I thought it was kind of weird. And now I look at it and I shudder. I shudder to think. Because God said, you will not take blood. Blood belongs only to me, he said. And the reason is because the blood represents the life, and the life belongs to me. You can drain the life out, but it's got to go on the ground because it belongs to me. Then you can eat the meat. The life isn't in the meat. The life is in the blood. You let the life go, and then you can have the meat. So the animals are going to be afraid. The animals are going to be food. And notice, too, that the animals are going to be responsible. Did you ever think about that? I will require your lifeblood from every beast. I will require it. Did you ever think about the fact that God actually will not allow animals to kill humans? And that's why, and even in a pagan culture, an animal that kills a human is a dangerous animal, and they will do whatever's necessary to destroy that animal. Did you know that that's part of the Noahic covenant? And God said, I will not allow, and I will deal even with animals who take human life. You say, well, how can he deal with animals? Does he call animals into judgment? I don't know. But he says, I will require the lifeblood of every animal. I have no idea how animals relate to God. There's a lot of stuff he hasn't told us. But he's sure serious about human life. Then he says in verse 6, whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. This is the institution of capital punishment. This is back to the subject of the preservation of human life. We talked about the management. Now go back to the idea of the preservation of human life, because it's in God's image. He says, in essence, right here in the Noahic covenant, that capital punishment is actually part of his design. Now, he does not say that all that humans do in the name of capital punishment has been right. And don't get confused about that. But when people say, oh, I can't believe you as a Christian believe in capital punishment, what you need to remember is, clear back in the Noahic covenant, which, by the way, has never been abrogated, animals are still afraid of humans. We can still eat meat. The rainbow is still in the sky. We haven't gotten to that part yet, but the rainbow is still in the sky. The Noahic covenant is still in force. And it is in the Noahic covenant that he says, I respect human life to the point where if a person murders, I want that person judicially dealt with, and you may take their life from them. Now, this doesn't clarify a lot of stuff about manslaughter. That comes later. He clarifies all of that. And he always leaves room for grace and clemency. But all I'm saying here is he gives to man, humanity, the authority to take a human life for judicial reasons. So the argument about capital punishment that people use, well, you know, how can a Christian believe in capital punishment? Actually, isn't a very good argument against capital punishment. The scripture actually does support the idea. In fact, I want you to jot down a couple of passages along that line. In Acts 25, verse 11, the Apostle Paul, you don't have to turn, but write it down, Acts 25, 11. The Apostle Paul says he's been arrested, okay, and he's on trial for his life. And he makes an interesting comment. He says, if I've done something worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. Do you guys remember that from Acts 25? He's been arrested, and he says, if I've done anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. Now, it's very strange. If capital punishment is really to be considered a very unchristian thing, it's very strange that the premier apostle of grace and the theologian of the New Testament should say, even about himself, that if he had done something worthy of death, he does not refuse to die. Instead of arguing about the morality of capital punishment, he simply says, if I need to be executed, execute me. But then he goes on and says, if I haven't done anything worthy of being executed, then I'm going to appeal to Caesar. I'm going to the Supreme Court. And that's what he did. Also jot down Romans chapter 13, verse 4, which was written by the Apostle Paul. And he says, well, I'll paraphrase it. Romans 13, 4, but I'll paraphrase it. He says, do what the government says because they don't bear the sword for nothing. Now, what that means is capital punishment. They didn't spank people with swords. And the Apostle Paul is using capital punishment as an illustration. He's saying it does not bear the sword meaninglessly, meaning it has the authority to cut your head off. That's what they did with swords. He was speaking of capital punishment there. So, the idea of capital punishment is biblical. Now, again, let me stress, this does not mean that everything that's been done in the name of capital punishment in human history has been right, and it doesn't mean that God doesn't judge whole societies for how they handle this law. He does judge them. And it has been abused, and due process is vital, and mercy is always an option. Clemency is always an option to humanity, but not without taking seriously human life, and this is the key. Not without taking seriously human life. He says, human life is created in my image. Don't mess with it. It's also, by the way, implied by saying this, by man shall his blood be shed. Do you see the other implication here? Human government is implied. Has to be. Some form of human government has to be implied. Anarchy is not biblical. There has to be some form of human government. So the Noahic covenant gives us responsibility to preserve human life and to manage the earth. Furthermore, it gives us a great promise. Let's move into verse 8. So we've got blessing, responsibility, and now promise. He spoke to Noah through his sons and his sons with him and said, now behold, I myself do establish my covenant with you and with your descendants after you, and with every living creature that is with you, the birds and the cattle and every beast of the earth with you, all that comes out that came out of the ark, even every beast of the earth, and I establish my covenant with you and all flesh, never again to be cut off by water, underline that, by water of the flood. Neither shall there again be flood to destroy the earth. And God said, this is the sign of the covenant which I am making between me and you and every living creature that is with you for all successive generations. I set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a sign of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come about when I bring a cloud over the earth that the bow shall be seen in the cloud. And I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh. And never again shall the water become a flood to destroy all flesh. When the bow is in the cloud, I will look upon it and remember the everlasting covenant. Underline everlasting. Between God and every living creature of all flesh that is on the earth. And God said to Noah, this is the sign of the covenant which I've established between me and all flesh. All flesh, all flesh, all flesh. He keeps repeating it. He's saying, I've made a covenant with you and I've made a covenant with the animal kingdom. He said, in essence, this is what I am doing. And it's a marvelous promise. What he's saying is, I don't want you always in fear of the other shoe dropping and another flood occurring. I want you to live with some confidence that there is going to be a system, that we're going to have seasons. He said, not that there will never be droughts, and not that he wouldn't use the weather at times to rebuke Israel, which he did do. But he said, I'll never completely destroy the thing. Trust me. Do you believe that it's okay to trust that life is going to go on in some form? Or do you live your life in constant fear of the other shoe dropping out of heaven because of something going wrong? Let me remind you of something, especially when you're walking in the covenant with God. He did not design us to live constantly worried, jumping every time any little thing went wrong in our life. Always fearful, always wondering, is God judging me? Is God mad at me? Something must have gone wrong. That's superstition. That's the way pagan people live who serve demons and who are always afraid when every little thing goes wrong. And you know what? Unfortunately, I've known Christians who don't learn the lesson of the rainbow. The lesson of the rainbow is when you're in covenant with God, you don't have to always be afraid. It's not that difficult things won't ever happen, but you don't always have to be afraid of God. And that's obviously what he's getting across here. That's why he put the rainbow there. You say, well, I know. No, the rainbow's not a miracle. The rainbow is light refracted through the water and the droplets and so on and so forth. Yeah, we know all about it. Really, where'd the water come from? Where'd the light come from? Who created all the spectrums of the light? Who put the lens up there in front of the sun to make it show in all these colors? And colors we can't even see! We can't even see them with our eyes. Who did all that? See, just because we understand a little bit of the physics doesn't mean it's not a miracle. It still happens. And this was, in all probability, the first time that they had seasonal rains. And that's so when they first saw it, they thought to themselves, wow, the promise from God. Notice the Noahic covenant. And notice these things about the Noahic covenant. It is unilateral. That means God himself said it. He didn't say, as long as you're nice to me, I'll keep bringing these things. He says, this is the way it's going to be, period. You will have seasons. This is the way it's going to be, period. You'll have rainbows. This is the way it's going to be, period. The animals are going to be afraid of you. You're going to be able to eat meat. But you will not, I repeat, he says, you will not take human life. And any animal that takes human life, I want you to kill it. Any human that takes human life wantonly, I want you to kill them. And you will not drink blood. He says, this is simply the way it is. He's restarting covenant, and it's a unilateral thing. It's all him. He didn't say, do you like this? Do you think we ought to compromise on something? What do you think of these? Noah, do you like these rules? He didn't say any of that stuff. He said, this is the way it's going to be. It's a unilateral covenant. Notice, too, secondly, not only is it unilateral, it's universal. It's not just with Israel. It's with all humans. The Noahic covenant sticks for all human beings, which is why capital punishment, by the way, and the whole issue of human life being precious is universal. It's not just for the covenant people of God. It's for all humans. And finally, it's everlasting. He says this is never going to stop. What he means is not that he will never bring judgment against the earth. He will never use nature to judge the earth. You know what the earth is going to be judged by next time? What did Jesus say? As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man. The earth will be judged, but it will be by the Lord personally returning and judging it. And it'll be very obvious what's going on. It won't just be 40 days of rain and a huge deluge of nature turning on humanity and destroying it. He said, I will not allow that. But he didn't say, I will never judge humanity again. He said, I won't use nature to do it, so you don't have to worry about the other shoe dropping out of heaven on those issues. But he did say, when I come back, personally, and I roll back the scroll and I appear personally, then I'll close the chapter. And that there is another judgment coming. You can jot that down. It's Matthew 24:37. We looked at it last week. So, we'll get back to this in a minute. Let's move on to the third aspect of the chapter, and that is the continuation of sin. Let me just tell you what happened in this story, because we're running out of time, I am informed. Noah became a farmer, and he was a successful farmer, and he grew grapes, and with grapes he made wine, and he drank a bunch of wine, and he got naked in his tent. Isn't that horrible? It's what happened. Drank a bunch of wine, got naked in his tent. And he had his three sons were outside the tent, and Ham walks in there and he gawked at his father. The Hebrew word, it says he looked at him. The Hebrew word means he gawked at him. did not cover him, walked back outside and squawked, gawked and squawked. Okay, I want you to remember that. Is this good memory device? Gawked and squawked. He went back out to his brothers and said, "Hey, Dad's naked and drunk in the tent." In the Hebrew word that is used for tell in the story means to broadcast it. And one guy translated it this way, broadcast with delight, to tell it with delight. Well, Noah finally woke up. Before he woke up, the other two sons, Shem and Japheth, walk in backwards. They hear what their brother said. They do not agree with how he dealt with this. They take a big blanket and they walk in backwards, not looking at their naked dad who's drunk laying in there. And they walk in backwards and they lay the blanket over him. They don't look at him. And then they go back out and they wait till Dad sleeps it off. And he slept it off and he woke up and he saw the blanket and he realized, Now, it doesn't say how he figured out that Ham had done this, that Ham had made fun of him. But it does say he figured it out. And he pronounces a prophecy. It's not as much a curse as it is a prophecy, and I want you to understand that, but read it. Verse 25. He said, "Cursed be Canaan." Canaan was actually the son of Ham, and there's a reason he mentions this, because this is the father of the Canaanites in the land of Canaan. "Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants he shall be to his brothers." And he also said, "On the other hand, blessed be the Lord, the God of Shem," whose apparently it was his idea to walk in backwards, "and let Canaan be his servant, and may God enlarge Japheth, and let him dwell in the tents of Shem, and let Canaan be his servant." And Noah lived 300 more years after, 350 years after the flood, and all the days of Noah were 950 years, and he died. Now, this little account is a kind of a bizarre little story, actually, and you got to ask yourself why it's here. Let me explain just a couple things, and then we'll close it up. First of all, what precisely was the sin? You ever wonder in this story? What was the sin that occurred? Was it Noah drinking too much and getting drunk? Getting drunk is not a good idea. The Bible in the New Testament says it's a sin. In the Old Testament, it says not to do it. It says it's utter foolishness. But this text does not rebuke Noah for this. I've heard many devotionals on how horrible it was for Noah to get drunk. It probably was, but that's not what the text says. The Bible doesn't rebuke Noah for this. I am not carrying a brief for getting drunk and naked, you understand. And it is interesting how often those two things do go together in human history. And so I'm not saying that drunkenness is good. Well, was it the sin of nakedness? Is being naked a sin? I hope not. Everybody's naked under their clothes. So there you are. He just had a tent instead of clothes. You know, that the clothing was further away from him, you might say. And it wasn't an orgy. He fell asleep. So it wasn't the nakedness. Although nakedness is a dangerous state of being, and most people do not want to be naked in public. Okay? You understand this? And drunken nakedness is a dangerous state of being, for sure. And okay, all right, we understand all that. But again, God doesn't rebuke Noah in the text. Now, you can draw inferences and say, well, it would have been better if he didn't do this. Uh-huh, yeah. He probably felt that way too. But that's really not, it can't be the moral of the story in the text, ultimately. Well, then what is it? Well, it's found in the rebuke that he gives to Ham, and the sin has to be Ham's attitude towards his father's nakedness. And I think the key phrase in understanding it, and by the way, you can read a dozen commentaries and they just go to town on this story, okay? It's the stuff PhD stuff is made of. You write long stuff nobody will ever read about, you know. But honestly, the key is understanding one very simple thing. He didn't cover him. He gawked and he squawked and he didn't cover it. And it wasn't that he wasn't covering sin, it was that he wasn't covering the embarrassment of his father. Now, to us, we say to ourselves, is this an important thing? In that culture, there was no more direct dishonor to a father's person than what happened here. And the moral of this story is found in the rebellious heart of Ham, and in the fact that he would rather ridicule his own father than deal with his dad's embarrassment at the time. He did not deal honorably with his father. That is absolutely certain. There's a lot of speculation about other possibilities too. But one thing is for certain, and that is he dealt dishonorably with his father. Whereas the other two, and you can see the difference between them, and it's in the contrast of the passage, the other two dealt honorably with him. And so when he wakes up, he makes a prophecy. He said, this man rebelled, dealt dishonorably with me. His descendants will be dishonorable, and they will be slaves. And indeed, as a matter of fact, the Canaanite cultures, as we'll see when we get into those accounts, the Canaanite cultures were terribly debauched and dishonorable. So he prophesies against him. And we'll see more about Shem and Japheth and some of the honor that comes to them as a result of this. But all I want to point out from the story, very simply, is that what he's saying is that the reason the account is there is to remind us that the sin of humanity is still there. Even in Noah's inappropriate, you might say, behavior, the sin is still there. By the way, let me mention something. There's no such thing as a perfect family. Even families who look like they should be on the cover of Focus on the Family magazine, The Perfect Family, you find out when you get to know anybody that there's stuff in the tent. You know? And so if there's stuff in your tent and you're going, man, oh man, got to keep those tent flaps closed. If anybody found out the dysfunction in our family way back and now even, oh my goodness, it'd be horrible. And so, you know, we're always afraid of that. Let me just remind you, even in Noah, who was the only righteous family on earth when the flood came, after the flood came, he got drunk and got too happy and got naked in his tent. And God said, you see, all families are sort of dysfunctional. That's just a little sidelight, just a little reminder. And the reason it's in the text is to remind us that sin has not left the human soul. And even the redeemed human soul, given the opportunity, can still sin, and sin grievously, as is evidenced by Ham, who was a godly man. And yet, when given the opportunity to rebel, he did, and to dishonor his father, he did. And he passed that on to his sons. And there was, you might call it a curse. It's an awesome thing. The sin continues. So what we have is God saying, I'm restarting worship. I'm restarting covenant. And here's the shape of it. But I'm letting you know, sin is still resident in the human soul. I want to close with one reminder. It's the reminder of the rainbow. I don't want to close with the reminder of sin being resident in the human soul. It's not a very happy way to close the account. And it's not really the way the Bible ends. The Bible ends by saying that God intends to bless, and that's the reminder of the rainbow. In this covenant that he brings through Noah, what he's saying in essence is, I will always judge sin. Our Heavenly Father says, I will always judge sin, but it is not my intent. I did not create humanity for cursing. I created humanity to bless. And that reminds us, you guys, that if we will come to him in his new covenant, we will live in his blessing no matter what else happens on this earth. He says, I am going to bless. You read the last chapter of the book of Revelation, or the last couple of chapters, and you can see that his intent for humanity is to bless. My question to you is, are you part of that covenant, and do you want to be blessed? Because God is not hateful, despite the fact that he pours out this judgment. He starts with us over and over, like I opened this evening's Bible study with. He keeps working with us. He is not hateful. He does not hate humanity, though he has every reason to. He doesn't. He says, I'll work with you. I will forgive you. Work with me. Be in my covenant. Walk with me. Trust me. That's what we need to do. And that's what we need to learn from these passages. Father, thank you for reminding us of these things. Thank you for this covenant. It is a mysterious thing that we see still functioning in our world today. And so every time we see a rainbow, we are reminded of your faithfulness to humanity and your intention to bless by your grace. And that reminds us of the way in which you bless us through your Son. It all reminds us, Lord, that you have this world under control, and we rejoice in that. So we come before you this evening, Father, thanking you for your word, thanking you for your wisdom, thanking you for your covenants to us, this one in which we still live, actually, and thanking you for your promise, despite the fact that sin is resident in our souls and shows itself. Despite that, your mercy is still here. Thank you, Father, in Jesus' name. Amen.